You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 5th of August, 2020. I want to begin on a sad note. My colleague and the former editor of the Barnes Review, John Tiffany, has passed away. When I was hired by Willis Carter with the Barnes Review, and to some extent, the Spotlight newspaper, November 1st, 1999, John was the editor. Now, of course, the reality of that journal is that Willis Carter had to approve everything. Anything that went into that journal ultimately was his responsibility. That's how he viewed it, and we were employees, which is fine by us, of course. So a term like editor, whether I was the editor or John or anyone else, is a bit of a stretch. Now, today, things are different. Those there now don't have that same kind of authoritarian personality, though people like Willis Carter certainly have earned it over the decades. And John and I became fast friends. John was never really a movement guy, or if he was, he was very quiet about it. John was very easy to get along with. John was maddening in his absolute obsession with detail. He certainly was off his rocker in many ways, which is certainly nothing any of us can criticize him for. He drove everyone crazy, but he did it with the purpose of a thorough in trying to get the journal as perfect as humanly possible. None of us, of course, are perfect. I eventually replaced John, to his chagrin, very shortly after I got there. Nevertheless, as we both knew, that largely was on paper, since Willis Carter was the man who ultimately vetoed or accepted anything that went in or didn't get in to the journal. As the years went on, I think the last time I saw John in the flesh was the last time I saw Willis Carter, which was a American Free Press meeting, I want to say, 4 years ago in Upper Marlboro in Maryland, organized by my good friend Paul Angel, who I've known now for 20 years, and he had me as the keynote speaker or something like that. I knew that he was declining. I don't know what he had. I don't know what was happening, but I hardly recognized him. And as time went on, he had less and less to do with the journal, and I maintained contact with him, but it became more and more difficult. I'm not sure what he died of, but I know the last few years were not easy for him, and so he is a part of nationalist history. He is a part of revisionist history. He is a part of the development of this whole concept over the last 20, 30 years. And he's not a, even among nationalists, he is not a household name, but he held down the fort there. You know, we worked well together because I tended to think in big picture platonic elements, and John functioned in the most maddeningly detail-oriented way. You know, he would torment himself over whether a comma or a semicolon should be put somewhere. But that meant we work well. We work well together. For that reason, we had completely different personalities. I never saw John angry. I never saw him sad. I made him laugh a few times, but he maintained an extremely calm demeanor. He will be missed, and he was a friend of mine. And for some time, we were fairly close friends. The other piece of news is a bit happier. Some of you have heard of this already. But I received a letter last month from the Autonomous Orthodox Metropolia. It used to be called the Milan Synod. And because the name that they adopted over the last few years is so long and unwieldy that it didn't, we just call it the Milan Synod just out of so it's easy. It's the Autonomous Metropolia is catching on, but even that's a mouthful. So you know what happened with us going on 4 years now. It'll be 4 years in September, where I was removed from that group. And it was very odd. The entire thing was weird. I received a letter of apology from them, a description of actually what happened, the quote-unquote foreign elements who had infiltrated the group with the sole purpose of getting me out. They have been neutralized, as I'm told. They described everything that happened to me in depth, and they apologized profusely. And, of course, have offered me my role in the Synod back again, to return. There was a rumor that a few people spread that I was excommunicated. That was never the case. That never happened. That was never even a topic for discussion. I was simply removed. That's not, obviously two very different things. But even more than that, I was never actually deposed. Now, that was a surprise. It was a recommendation that was never entered. It was never signed. It was never given the official seal. It simply didn't happen. I was never deposed from that particular group. And so the whole thing was very confusing. And for them to apologize, for them to ask me to return, for them to assure me that this sort of thing won't happen again, and then congratulate me on at least the last few shows. This is about a month ago, so my broadcasts, they said, were excellent and top-notch, as I said. I brought a lot of those guys into the Synod, into Orthodoxy, and put that group on the map. I mean, very few people had heard of them before I began talking about them. And there were just one or two of us out there online that they really had no presence prior to that. And I'm very happy to have given them an online presence and a reputation that they wouldn't have had otherwise. So it takes a lot for them to contact me and to apologize and to admit that they were wrong. And so I truly appreciate it. And I will see what happens from there. But the truth is that I was never removed. That never happened. Nothing was signed. That was just simply words on paper. It never happened. I was never removed. I was never. It was just more or less a recommendation that never actually was signed or sealed or filed away in the official archives. So there's some good news there. There is some bad news there. And it shows you how things can develop. These are very, very intelligent men. They're very pious men. I've known them for a long time. And for them to have been taken in by people, I don't know who these people are, who the minute I was removed, suddenly disappeared. So it was an infiltration. And they kicked themselves. I mean, it could happen to anybody. It happens all the time. But apparently, I guess I'm more significant in the Orthodox world than I ever thought I was, that my enemies would take such time to get rid of me. And so I truly appreciate their efforts. That being said, one of the things that John Tiffany was very, very interested in, and he loved the idea of obscure ancient topics. The ancient world, the white and redhead mummies of China, all of those type of stories very much concerned him. John was a materialist. I think he was an atheist of sorts, but you never knew. Every other day he had a new weird religious affiliation. Sometimes I think he did it just to irritate us all, but it really came from the fact that the ancient world was a huge preoccupation for him. And so, in honor of John, I want to talk about something. I've done broadcasts on this before. I published several times on this topic, but I have expanded my research in this absolutely essential area. And that is the nature of what the Mongol or so-called Tartar control over Russia in the Middle Ages amounted to. I think I've said on this show before, in some depth, that in Russia, as well as Mongolia itself, there is no belief there was ever any East Asian domination of the Russian polity at any given time. There are no records of this anywhere. The concept of Mongol is a relatively new one. The tribes that attacked Russia from the south never referred to themselves as anything even approaching Mongol or Tartar. To think that a group of scattered nomads can, in the space of a generation, take on and defeat all the great powers of the day and suddenly learn how to not only mobilize hundreds of thousands of men and siege engines and everything else to dominate most of the known world, but then to administer a gigantic empire on top of it, all in the same lifetime of one man, is of course absurd. There are no genetic traces of East Asian blood in Russia, no matter how hard you might try. I have been over hundreds of articles in the Russian language on this topic, and it's nowhere to be found. You're talking about a group of people in a very sparsely populated East Asian plain, somehow doing this in the space of a few years. It's simply absurd. But there are no local written records of the very existence of this empire in Mongolia itself. And as far as any authentic chronicles, they're not mentioned there either. They have left behind zero architectural monuments. There was no linguistic, legal, or cultural borrowing from this East Asian people. No discernible economic consequences. There's no ruins in the capital of the Golden Horde at Sarai in the south. Nothing at that location would suggest that anything significant ever occurred there. And I went over some of the basic problems with the theory of the Mongol invasion and defeat of all of Russia. But even worse than that, how the so-called occupation didn't make any sense. No one has ever answered the question how a group of nomads suddenly became a highly advanced civilization with heavy cavalry, division of labor, all this in the space of a decade or two. Now, Lev Gumilev, who I've did entire broadcasts on, I've written on him, his research in the ancient documents strongly suggests that the Mongols were in fact Scythians, which is, you know, an Aryan people. And the Sarmatians are also a branch of the Scythian people. Julius Pomponius claims that these were Slavonic, or at least an Aryan-based people. And even more so, now there's a problem, the words for Mongol and Tartar. Sometimes they're used the same, sometimes they're different, sometimes there's different shades of subtlety. As I've argued many times, that the Horde was in fact what we would call today a Cossack army. And it is true, as Gumilev will say, that the Cossacks were called Tartars in the 18th century, and even later. The Byzantine writers the ancient world. Well, roughly, I mean, ancient world. We're talking roughly, you know, 6th, 7th century and a bit beyond. Byzantine writers equate Rus, Slav, Avar, Scythian as essentially one group. Well, I think actually a bit later than 6th, 7th century, of course. Leo the Deacon. The Scythians are, in fact, Russians. The Kagan, or Hadjan, the title used even in the Baltics. And yet, with all the damage, allegedly, that these Mongols and Tartars did, there are no records or books of this East Asian horde. And many of you know, and I know I have a pretty literate audience, many of you are aware that Genghis Khan, which really isn't a name, it's a title, as well as Tamerlane, came much later, were always described by contemporaries as Europeans. But even today, your so-called Tartars in Russia are not identical to the Tartars that we're referring to. Gumilev's theory is that Scythian is a Greek term for shield bearer, and they call themselves Rus. They had tremendous urbanization, a tremendous economy. But the notion of this East Asian invasion isn't the case. Rashid Adun, a contemporary writer, claims that Genghis was white. That Temuchin is a name of Russian origin. Bati, Berki, Mamang, these are Scythian names. In other words, Lev Gumilev, who I know many of my listeners are familiar with, essentially the Tartar yoke was the Scythian military control over Russia. The Slavic Khaganate of Kumblak was observed by Marco Polo. He writes back, he saw 200 cities, paved roads, infrastructure, and the same sort of, you know, economy that you might expect from the Scythians. Byzantium was very consistent on this respect. Scythian, Russian were the same, eventually the Scythians absorbed by the Sarmatians. That the Cumans, who are usually referred to in the literature as Turkish, had blonde hair. They were heirs of the Sarmatian Scythian civilization, not nomads at any point. And the term horde, which you know has these negative connotations, so it says uncivilized group of people, is the same for genus, or even in Ukrainian Rada. Like Great Scythia, in Gumilev's opinion, is the, for lack of a better phrase, a super ethnos of Russia. And this is of extreme significance. And I've not dealt with this in great detail. But in essence, based on what roughly modern-day Ukraine, southern European Russia, and the Crimea, Western Scythians were ruled by the royal Scyths, or Scythes, whatever you want to call them, from the Bessa region. And they defeated Darius I of Persia, which was a gigantic deal. And they received their income and their money by controlling a portion of the Silk Road. Of course, the massive trade network connecting Greece, Persia, India, China, and of course helped build these civilizations and civilization in general. And going way back beyond my area of competence, as early as the 7th century BC, crossing to the Caucasus and raided into the Middle East, along with the Cimmerians. And they played a very important role in the developments of the area. And that these, you know, proto-Rus are absolutely essential in global civilization in this period of time. But at some point, roughly 3rd century AD, after the demise of the Han Dynasty, in China, the eastern Scythians crossed the Pamir Mountains and settled in western, what we know, the western Turan Basin. And the kingdom of Khotan, at least partly from these people, was then conquered by several other khanates, which unfortunately led to the Islamicization later on of northwestern China, the way we know it today. But regardless of that, by the early Middle Ages, the Scythians and their Sarmatian cousins were eventually assimilated and absorbed by the Proto-Slavic population of Russia. And by this time, the steppe was already a major exporter of grain. Even the ancient artwork in Gumilev's work, Russian and Scythian artwork, is very similar. Writers like P.N. Schultz would say that Scythia and Rus are identical material culture, even not just similar, but identical. That Great Tartary and the Mongol warrior were, in fact, Russians, stemming from these people. But Sarmatian, Scythian, clearly of a Caucasoid appearance. And judging by the skeletons, and this is, I remember speaking with John Tiffany about this at great length, the Sarmatian noblemen often were almost 6 feet tall from their skeletons. But we know them, they had sturdy bones, they had long hair and beards. And in the very early 3rd century AD, Galen, of course, the famous Greek physician, noted that the Sarmatians and Scythians had red or reddish hair, depending on how you translate it. So this isn't merely something that's a new development. Guys who support the new chronology also believe in some version of this, but writers in Gumilev's school as well are starting to abandon the notion, or have abandoned the notion, that there was anything like the Mongol Empire, at least the Mongol Empire, that had anything to do with Russia. And when you go over the survey history, that is to say, your large books, you know, Russia from, you know, Rurik to Nicholas or whatever it is, these questions aren't even brought up, let alone answered. But in my opinion, and I've said this before, that you can't square this circle. Nomadic peoples don't suddenly develop the capability to launch massive military operations and sophisticated forms of colonial rule. The groups that the Khan oversaw in the Far East function like any other pre-modern unsettled group of nomads. But somehow in a few years they were capable of running the most massive army the world had ever seen up until that point. It can't possibly be true. Now, there's also a theory, and I think I mentioned this before, that N.A. Morozov and many others have argued that the word Mongol is really a misunderstanding. It simply referred to people, a great people, Megalian. You get the prefix mega from it, the Greek word. Megalian, that means great. And even, Eastern Russia was called Great Russia. The Mongol Empire then would be identical to the Great Empire, that is, the state of medieval Russia. And this is a problem for the traditional history, and you can't really get any more significant than this, because for so many years, Russia was considered outside of the European mainstream, which of course it was, but not for these reasons, was considered to have at least some connection to East Asia, to have some connection racially or at least culturally to this very foggy, very vague Mongol Empire. But many years ago, as I was writing The Third Rome, I couldn't get over the fact that Tsar Ivan IV placed on the throne when he decided to retire, put a converted Tartar on the throne. This hasn't been fully explained. And he did this without any, racial concerns. No one ever said that this was a problem because he's not Russian or anything like that. That was never the issue. In other words, as a converted Tartar, well, he was never any different than any other Slav. I strongly doubt that Russians would be that tolerant that they'd be good with a former colonial master now ruling them because Tsar Ivan IV wanted to retire. And not just Gumilev, many others have concluded that the word Tartar is just a catch-all term for all Eurasian fighters. your basic account, and unfortunately one that I accepted many years ago, showing the Mongols master of the Russian terrain. They'd never acted like they were strangers. They couldn't have been foreign. They knew the Russian terrain extremely well. Now, Gumilev's work has roughly maybe 35,000 maximum of that entire horde, wherever they're from, having any Asian roots, and they were, of course, from Central Asia, not the Far East. They were auxiliaries at best. There's the claim that the Mongols swept into Russia in the wintertime. This is bizarre. Given the size of the army, and of course the Asian propensity to have 3 horses per warrior, if you have 100,000 men, that means you have 300,000 horses. How can they forage in the wintertime? And it really never even dawned on me that horses can't ride on ice without breaking their legs. I'm no expert on, no hippophile, but I don't know how that could possibly work. All Russian princes in the Middle Ages used so-called Tartar armies. Rus-Tartar was not an uncommon way to refer to Russians, Russian soldiers in general, at that point. The travelers of the day, of course, Carpini, the papal legate, who wrote the most on these people, never acted as if Tartars, Mongols, and Rus were any different. There was no physical dissimilarity between the groups. Nor did anyone ever say that they needed translators. Not one time. The problem, you know, since this program, I think, started off in, I don't even remember what year. I think my very first or maybe the second program was a criticism of Peter the Great. You know that's been one of my big issues. And one of the great crimes that he committed was burning the local histories of all Russia. The documents that dictated a nobleman's place in society were essentially history books explaining his family's role, their heroism, their failures, their successes, their money, where they're from. They were history books. Now, if you read the Anglo-American text, they'll say, well, Peter was so concerned with the meritocracy and not aristocratic precedent that he had these books burned so that there can be no reference to history, only who pleased Peter the most. Now, that doesn't make any sense, because the whole point of these histories was to give an account of why these families were noble in the first place. And why burn them? Why hunt them down and demand that every page be destroyed? All revolutions, actual true revolutions, try to destroy the history of what came before them, attempting to wipe it out. And there's been a few times that was successful. In Albania and Pol Pot in Cambodia attempted to do that and may even have succeeded as much as humanly possible. So many of the histories prior to Peter have been destroyed. Your typical documents and works that a normal historian in a normal society would refer to don't exist in the Russian case. Every once in a while, I come across somebody who wants to claim this Mongol, meaning East Asian, Russian connection. Well, there's something, the problems there are just, they're overwhelming. I've mentioned to even my personal friends as well as in debates and everything else, look at the paintings and miniatures even, done by contemporaries of the battles with the so-called Mongols. And you can't tell the difference between the two sides. They are identical. They're depicted as absolutely the same. Their armor, their horses, their flags, everything. But these very same artists, if they're talking about, say, a Turkish group or Western Europeans, you can clearly tell who's who. I mean, even Sweden, you could tell who's who. Very few realize that a Tartar helped remove the Crusaders from Constantinople. I'm sorry, a Tartar army. After the 1204 devastation, St. Alexander Nevsky had a large Tartar army, and they usually always served Russian interests. It's odd that this invading force never bothered to leave a garrison there. What kind of clone? I mean, this is, you know, and I mentioned, and Gumilev says this, and so many of the specialists in ancient Russia referred to the fact that the old name for Russia was Great Tartary, that a Tartar was someone in the service of the Tsar, having no connection with an ethnic marker. Gumilev and so many others make the argument, or made the argument, that the word Tartar as an ethnic group appeared roughly 300 years ago for the very first time. Some people have tried to make the claim that this goes back to ancient China. This is very, very speculative. No one's quite sure of the language or anything else. So I'm not really sure what kind of conclusion you can come to. But at least in Russian history, as an ethnic category, Tartar didn't exist until roughly three centuries ago. I already noted, and I will keep noting this, and again, this is something that John and I used to talk about all the time, that Genghis was not Asian. I mentioned Rashid Din, or Dun, depending on who you read, who was a contemporary, by the way, and he says, quote, "The children of the Khan were born with mostly gray-blue eyes and blonde hair." So these are not East Asians. If you go through, and I have right here in my office, I have the documents, both translated and in Russian, contemporary Russian, of those who are talking about the Mongol invasion at the time. No one ever notes that they're a different race. No one ever says that they speak a different language. Even back when I wrote my first book, it struck me how quickly Russian cities fell to pieces. Kiev, of course, the center of old Russia, fell to the invaders in a matter of a few days. But during the Polish invasion of Smolensk during the time of Troubles, they laid siege to the city with far, you know, more advanced equipment, and it took from September 21st, 1609 to June 3rd, 1611 to finally take the city. And it was only when the gates were finally breached and the people on the inside were finally ravaged by hunger and disease. That's how a normal siege went in medieval Russia. Many have noted that the clergy were tax exempt. And there is no good reason for any colonial body to do this, knowing full well that the clergy in the Russian Orthodox Church were always extremely nationalist, believing in one national royalist Russia. No decentralization, no pieces of this Rus, no one sole empire. That the Mongols somehow permitted large armies of natives under native rulers. Nothing made any sense to me. And at the time, I mean, this is many years ago, I didn't know what to do with this information. Why are Mongols mobilizing huge armies of Slavs? Why are they always working for each other? You'll hear in the modern Western literature that it shows you how tolerant the East Asian empires were compared to the European or the Russian, precisely because they patronized the Orthodox clergy. This was almost a golden age for the monasteries, all of whom were well known to be not only religious centers, but political and military centers. These were fortresses in many cases. Now, I'm not saying that Gumilev went so far as so many others to claim that the Mongol Khan and the Great Emperor were one and the same, although there's plenty of people right now who do. But it is also true that calling Russians Tartars and vice versa was normal in the Middle Ages. You know, part of the whole problem, you know, Marco Polo was someone that I finally had to go and read the English translations of his travels. I used to believe, like everyone else, that the so-called Mongol occupation retarded Russian development. And that 200-year, roughly 200-year interval explains, you know, the constant catching up. Now, of course, I knew that wasn't true, because during the reign of Tsar Alexis, for example, they were easily very similar to Central Europe, for example. In terms of, you know, publications and scientific establishment, that was not a big problem. But Marco Polo makes reference to the infrastructure, the postal service, the efficiency of government of Russia under the so-called Horde. The very first firearms were used at the Battle of Gulikovo. However, the concept of Russian backwardness only developed under the reign of Peter the Great, and that was a way to justify his revolution and his destruction of the old society. But it gets more complicated. I know I've mentioned this before, I've gone over this stuff before, but over the last few months, I began to note some new information. So-called Mongols were found in Russia before the invasion. The bulk of the armed services, the labor forces of the so-called Golden Horde, were Russians. The bureaucrats, everyone, seemed to be Russian. I don't know who the Mongols were then. The composition of the border population along the Terek River were Russians. The bureaucratic system of the Golden Horde were Russians. So-called Mongols didn't have clerks, writers, or accountants. So what kind of empire is this? Now, somehow they had the ability to destroy all the great powers of the day, but they didn't know how to add. And people who know something about the nature of military conquest, knowing how to add and knowing how to run an army are not unrelated things. An army is a bureaucratic organization. Therefore, an empire based on an army is not that much of a stretch. But Russia was called Tartary Mongolia for some time. This was an old name for Russia. And the headquarters of the Khan, from the first days of the formation of the Horde, an Orthodox church was built, and an entire diocesan staff existed. The formation of military settlements within the Horde, churches were built everywhere. Clergy were educated, seminaries were founded, hierarchies established. Metropolitan Cyril from Novgorod moved to live in Kiev, where he restored the Metropolitan of all Russia. Now, I don't know how the Mongol conqueror did not know the Russian, didn't really have a language even of his own that was written down at the time, didn't know the Russian language, much less the Orthodox faith, build an entire Orthodox structure in the areas that he conquests, one hostile to him, by the way. So Cyprian moved to the city right after it was conquered? The only thing that makes any sense is that the Mongols, in fact, were Orthodox Rus. They were a different faction. They were a different, it's different from the rest of Rus, as say the Cossacks were to Muscovites, in the 16th century. A relationship, something like that. Foreign writers, almost without fail, describe the Golden Horde as a Russian state. Now, during the so-called conquest, foreigners didn't describe Russia, since it was already called Tartar Mongolia in many places. It's a foreign term, of course. But Tartary was a way to denote medieval Russia roughly until the 16th century. Then it became Muscovy. Abul Muhammad, whose nickname was Ibn Hakl, writing in roughly 967 in the Book of Ways, he says, Russia consists of three tribes, one of which is the closest to the Bulgar. The king of this Rus tribe lives in Kuibia, which is the name for Kiev. Another tribe further north is called Slavian, and the third is called Artania, which was their term for the Horde. All of these were Rus people. All of these were Slavs. In 1968, the historian A.A. Gordiev writes the following. Historians were silent on the Moscow Chronicles, where information exists about the existence of the Cossacks as part of the army of the Golden Horde and their participation in the Muscovite forces prior to Ivan IV. The name Cossack was coined for part of the troops that made up the light cavalry among the armed forces of the Horde. In the middle of the 12th century, independent tribes lived in East and Central Asia, and they were called Cossack Hordes. After the conquest of Russia by Khan Batu, the clergy, church property, church registered population were exempt from paying tribute. The first prince in the Russian principalities, the Mongols, put on Suzdal, Prince Yaroslav the Solotovich. Strangely enough, the Tartar tribute was a tenth, which is weird because that is definitely a European fraction. The decimal system was not in use in northern China in the Middle Ages, I'm pretty certain. That, of course, was the Orthodox tithes. And how odd it is that the Russian army after the conquest was never dissolved. No one was ever disarmed. But those in the school of Gumilev have written that, and again, not everyone in Gumilev's school accepts that, even Gumilev himself didn't, but he laid the groundwork for it. The Tartars were called Russians. You can find this in Western Europe as well. In Rousselon's documents, we mentioned white Tartars along with yellow Tartars. And he lists names. The names of the white Tartars are Lucia, Martha, Maria, Catherine, many others. These aren't Asian names. Arab writers always say, they unequivocally say, that the so-called Mongol occupation was Russian. Somehow, the Mongols conquer a nation and then make sure that the conquered people have their own army, have their own bureaucracy, have their own rulers, and in fact, their own colonial administration is entirely Slavic. This isn't how colonial empires normally function. If you look at the Laurentian Chronicle and sections from 1223 to 1239, what they really do is they describe the unification of old Russia, and they describe it around, at least in one case, the city of Rostov. Now, Tartars are mentioned, except there are no leaders ever mentioned, no institutions are ever mentioned. They are in no circumstances in this chronicle considered different from Russians in any serious way. Strangely enough, the spoils of war, their so-called victories, are always used to the advantage of Russian princes. And I've come across this so many times, but when you read this for the first time, believing the traditional point of view of the Asiatic invasion, if you believe that to begin with, you then impose that image onto the words you read, which is a big problem. And it's very easy because you have a picture in your mind that you begin to kind of fill in the blanks rather than actually read what's on the page. So it says, for example, after the first victory of the Tartars over the Russian princes in Kiev, they mention that, of course, you know, Russia is crying to heaven for mercy and vengeance, tears of sorrow. Now, Russian prince Vasilko, who was sent by Yuri Solovyov, went from, of course, the Chernigov and returned to the city of Rostov. Glory to God and the Mother of God. Right in the same, almost not quite in the same paragraph, but in the same story. Now, I don't remember when I first read this, it didn't even strike me, but it seems that he is happy about the victory of the Tartars. Now, he clearly was. He was delighted with this victory and returned to his city of Rostov. And the only reason is, of course, these were one Russian faction fighting another one. It describes Tartars taking Kolomna, then Moscow, and Vladimir, Suzdal, you know, the major northern Russian cities. And they ultimately break the Russian resistance. Grand Duke Yuri, or George, is killed in battle. He describes the funeral. And then the chronicle will say, Yaroslav, son of the great Vsevolod, occupies the throne in Vladimir, and there was great joy among Christians. Well, you read this chronicle, and that doesn't make any sense. They're describing the Tartars destroying Russia, or at least their military backbone. They've taken all these major cities, and all the chronicle then after that talks about is all the Russians who take power in these very same cities. The Tartars just defeated the Russians and captured these major northern cities, and yet Russians are in power in every one of them, and no one mentions these wars as one of conquest. No one ever says these strangers who speak a different language and who look different and act different now have taken over. It's nowhere to be found. But they do mention Tartars taking over. Except they're not foreigners. But by that time, Russians in Vladimir Suzdal, which is the very beginning of the Muscovite era, are broken. This is supposed to be the very completion of the Mongol yoke. The country is supposed to be a disaster. It's flooded with blood, dominated by foreigners. Brutal aliens are supposed to be in power, called Tartars. And of course, as you're reading this, now you're waiting for, you know, a description of how Russians survived. They can't resist anymore. They go and bow to the Khan. But, you know, obviously, you know, once you know, the Russian army under Yuri is defeated, you would think that the Tartar conqueror would reign and or at least, you know, put puppets in charge or something like that. But you see none of this. He's supposed to, a Tartar group is supposed to have taken over these cities, and you never hear about him again. The ruler in Rostov is Yaroslav. Where's the Tartar Khan all of a sudden? There are no marks of conquest anywhere. And why is everyone so happy? There is no Tartar Khan. There's only the great Duke Yaroslav. And this is something that at the time when I first read this, I didn't understand. He takes power, and the Tartars somehow evaporate. And peace has been established under that particular city in that particular area. Then, of course, he mentions a royal daughter being born in Yaroslav, and then casually mentions, now this has been written elsewhere, the Tartars just took Kiev and went to fight the Hungarians. As if it's no big deal. Well, the writers in the New Chronology make a certain point, and as far as I know, none of this is in English. The common argument is that once Russia threw out the Mongol yoke, it rebuilt the Muscovite state on the centralized Mongol model, which, of course, none of that has ever been established at all. And the year that it was done was 1481, the so-called Stand on the Ugra, which is when Ivan III and his forces confronted the Mongol Khan Akhmat. And the story goes, and every Russian history textbook will tell you this, they stood against each other, they stared at each other for a while, and they left without a fight. They simply refused to fight one another. And yet, that very same year, in the very same chronicles, there was a Tsar Ivan Shabansky who attacked Akhmat with 15,000 Cossacks, broke into his capital, and killed him. So, the same year that there was a Stand on the Ugra, which was supposed to be the end of the Mongol yoke, there is brutal wars going on against these two forces. Then this Khan Ivan disappears from history. He sends the good news to Ivan Ivanovich and then disappears from the pages of history entirely. But since the princes of Moscow were Khans of the Horde by definition, they're the same person. He is the Khan. After defeating Akhmat, Ivan III defeats the Kazan Khan Abrim the following year. Then all of southern Siberia up to the Yod River, and then Novgorod all the way up to Vyatka. In other words, there's no difference between the Horde and the Muscovites. There's no explanation as to how in 1481 this Stand on the Ugra had anything to do with anything. They were still fighting one another. The Horde didn't disappear. Just one Khan succeeded another. The term Khan, by the way, I want to note, is never used in the original documents, only Tsar. So I have to be careful with what I say. But the term Khan is almost a subconscious way of differentiating the two sides. Same thing for Kagan, which was a term used really all over Eastern Europe, not just in Khazaria. You know, it's always odd. There's no Russian military formations taken from the Mongols. No weapons from the Mongols were ever borrowed or used or modified by the Moscow armies. And of course, no local folk memory among Mongols, or I guess what we used to call Tartars, still living there, the Buryats and all these other groups of people. Although, frankly, I don't think there's really any distinction, there's any continuity there whatsoever. But there is something else. Since there really was no Mongol yoke, there was a foreign occupation, or not, I shouldn't say a foreign occupation, but a foreign force that drained Russia of much of its treasure, and that was Khazaria. Now I'm going back strictly and reading from Gumilev's work. Gumilev is one of the great anthropologists and historians of in Russian 20th century history, states that the Khazars made the search for profit a national ideal. He calls them a chimera. And he defines a chimera as a meeting of two groups where one displaces the first, but still takes from the group that's been displaced. Kind of like the so-called barbarians moving into Rome. He makes sure to define the concept of a nomad as having no real stable tradition or attachment. Now, that this may be, he also says no morals. I'm not so sure that's true, but that's how he defines the term. However, in this particular case, he's only referring to the Khazarian, the initial stock of the Khazarian nomads. He refers to this Judaic takeover of Khazaria as an anti-system, and he says it's ruled by xenophobia. In the 10th century, the Greek Orthodox and Islam came together to fight Khazaria, with the notion that they were both being threatened, that they were the enemy of Eurasia. So you have two waves of migration that came to create the Khazar Empire. The first was refugees from the very eccentric socialist Mazdak movement, and then the much larger Jewish migration from Iran, Byzantine, and these were the Talmudists. Outside of Byzantium, the Talmudists. The second group, of course, is based largely on the slave trade. Obadiah seized power in Khazaria, and the Talmud was given all authority. And this is why he calls it the chimera. It's this artificial grafting of this bizarre Talmudic system onto an already existing people. They immediately destroyed Christianity in the empire that they took over. Gumilev also makes the claim that they invented the concept of total war. In other words, a total destruction of whatever population they're fighting. He also notes that once Khazaria was destroyed, Jews then flooded the Kievan region. And that beyond that, the Jewish domination in Spain under the Muslims was also called New Khazaria. These were not mostly Sephardim, but certainly many of them were. But if you read Gumilev's work on Khazaria, you note that he's referring to nomads as having no morals. He's only referring to this particular group. No connection to any terrain, any territory, pure xenophobia. But indeed, Russia comes from the confrontation. Has nothing to do with Mongols. This is almost a way to distract attention, historically. Gumilev also got in trouble, because again, he's writing at the end of the Soviet era. Soviet Jews attempted to ban research on Khazaria. Now, that is Gumilev's assertion. Vadim Kozov claims that the Russian reaction to Khazaria is far more significant than any kind of Mongol yoke. But also, both Kozov and Gumilev also make reference to the Bolshevik Revolution in Persia. Now, calling it Bolshevik is a bit propaganda, but this is a so-called Mazdak Revolt. Mazdak Revolt, he was a leader in Nishapur. I don't know how to pronounce the crazy ancient Persian names, but he became a prophet or called himself a prophet. And he began to claim that he was a Zoroastrian, and he claimed to have various revelations. One of them was that all men are born equal and have a right to maintain this equality. He claimed that he had a revelation that everything belongs to God. No definition of what that might be. And it's impious for anyone to claim to appropriate any property. Everything is the property of the, quote, creator. This is called, even in early Bolshevik history, the first Bolshevik movement. And a tight party state was established in Persia for a brief time after they overthrew King Kolbad, I believe. And Mazdak's movement, was a centralized, we can only call a socialist state, very proto-socialist state based on this in the Persian Empire. He created the Temple of Fire. Actually, it was called the Temple of Fire, Freedom, and Common Ownership. And of course, like all of these movements, women were taken as common property. I love that part is always there. The Mazdak Revolution probably deserves its own section. He died in roughly 528 AD. He was a Mobad in the Zoroastrian philosophical school, so-called, they called him Iranian reformer. And then he gained influence really during Kavda the First. He claimed to be a prophet of Ahura Mazda and created this, you know, tightly socialist one-party state. I should even note that it wasn't even so much an overthrow of Kadva the First going until 531, but that he converted. And this monarch was kind of taken over and used as his vehicle for this revolution. So-called pacifism, which was imposed by violence, anti-clericalism, which was odd at the time, and a purely socialist economy in the purely materialist sense of the term. The Mazdak revolution is very, very difficult to get your hands in. There's a lot of unanswered questions. It's not talked about excessively because of the really there's not as many documents as we would like. And of course, he was eventually overthrown. But he was, of course, a vegetarian, which is very strange. He did call for social revolution in the language of the day. And, of course, had a tightly controlled one-party state that dominated every aspect of life. So I shouldn't have mentioned that. I shouldn't have said that he overthrew the monarchy. He just used the monarchy. Basically the same thing. The reason I mentioned the Mazdak Revolution is that this was part of the movement that eventually moved into the region we now call Khazaria. So you really do have some connection to some proto-Bolshevism on the one hand and the development of the Khazar Empire on the other. And the years are slightly off, but it certainly doesn't harm the argument whatsoever. So now you have the Mazdak movement, and they're the refugees from this movement, so it was finally overthrown. And then a century later, the Talmudist movement. So now you have Talmudists coming in on top of a refugees from the Bolshevik. Once they were overthrown, they fled to what we today call Khazaria. So you really do have a kind of proto-Bolshevik and then later on the Talmudic movement sandwiching on top of one another, eventually taking over Khazaria and making it the first Jewish empire. And one of the reasons I want to mention, this is probably worth, I probably should have a whole broadcast for this, but I mention it because the Mongol yoke is often referred to as what produced, you know, the Muscovite state and the medieval Russia that we know today. Where the reality is, that was simply a Russian movement. The foreign movement that Russia reacted against that helped create its very being is Khazaria. And this is one of Lev Gumilev's great arguments in his career, where you have this extremely violent, profit-seeking, nomadic people who adopts an ideology that accepts slavery and the profit motive. After, of course, dealing, you know, living in an area where you have the followers of Mazdak having fled from Persia. So you have Talmudic nationalism on top of this kind of proto-Bolshevism. And you have, in this particular, and he calls it a chimera because it is a bizarre, amoral, purely cosmopolitan, and yet at the same time xenophobic. If you don't accept the ideology, you're out, without any connection to the land or even the people that you rule over. This became a problem. And this Mazdak claimed to have all of these crazy revelations that led to this so-called Bolshevik movement. As it began to wane, it engaged in a reign of terror before it finally was thrown out. And typically, you know, they would claim to be opposed to the rich of the empire. And the minute they took over, they became the wealthy. Now, I'm not saying that the whole concept of the Mongol yoke was developed to avoid talking about where Khazaria really came from. And that, but I am saying that Russia finds its origin ideologically in the wars against the Khazar Empire. Now, there was never any occupation of Russia. But in order to trade with the Greek and Middle East, or even Central Asian areas, you had to go through their system of tolls. And they, not to mention they were slave drivers, they enslaved tens of thousands of Russians. There is no connection between the word Slav and slave, by the way, just because they sound similar in 20th century English doesn't mean they are. That is, it's ridiculous. That's an aspect of amateur history that drives me crazy. In 20th century English, two words sound the same. Doesn't mean that 3,000 years ago, in some cases, they're similar. It's ridiculous. That's not the case. That's not the case here either. Nevertheless, they did enslave thousands of Russians in the southern part of the country, just outside of the borders of the empire. Finally, when it was smashed by the Kievans, Russia, distinguishing itself from this empire, really came into its own as an ideological and religious and ethnic organization that then, of course, soon developed into what we call the Moscow Empire, which was more or less centralized. There was no Mongol yoke in terms of a foreign occupation. The foreign organization that Russia did fight against was the Khazar Empire. That's what created Russia. I will be doing a separate broadcast on Mazdak and this proto-Bolshevik movement in the Persian Empire. There's so much work to be done on that yet. Documents are iffy. I'm not sure what's speculation and what's fact. I don't know the language. I'm no expert on the history. But no one else is doing it. So it's something I may have to delve into. Nations come into existence to some extent because they're differentiating themselves from a foreign body, whether it be colonial or just an enemy. No different than as we individuals do. The Mongol yoke didn't exist. However, the Khazar, Bolshevik, cosmopolitan, total war, profit slave-driving empire, however, did. And that's where medieval Russia got its identity, at least in the very, very broad sense of the term. Thank you, everyone, for listening yet again. I appreciate your assistance in every way. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you again next time. Bye-bye.